Welcome to In the Hive. This show tackles the news playing out in your community and examines the issues and ideas that connect us. I'm Roger McDonough. Today, a couple of conversations about the state of things. The bulk of today's show will feature a discussion with Black Lives Matter Utah founder Lex Scott, who has some words about protests, about what we should really be mourning, and about the way forward for police reform and truly addressing racism. That's coming up just ahead. First, though, we're going to check in with Salt Lake City Mayor Aaron Mendenhall. The mayor announced on Monday that a week-long curfew for the city was going into effect. She received a fair amount of criticism for that decision, and then yesterday afternoon announced that the curfew was being lifted. In a Zoom call on Wednesday, I asked the mayor about Salt Lake City's response to the protests and about the initial decision to implement a nighttime curfew.
We didn't want to have to put a curfew in place in the first place, but in assessing the national climate and local intelligence, working also in concert with our State Department of Public Safety, it was determined that that was the best course of action, was to put this in over the course of a week. And again, we were looking at a number of factors and what's happening in other cities. But we're also continuously evaluating those things. And I've been anxious and excited to get to a point where we could say Salt Lake City's back to being a place of peace and progress where we can lift that restriction. But I'll also note that in our city's history, we've really never had a protest that begins after 8 p.m. So the ability for people to protest from the morning until 8 p.m. Was something on the table, but we're grateful to lift that restriction.
Were you expecting, additional violent protests, against property or people or, police even when you implemented the curfew that was to extend for a week?
Well, obviously, that's what we were trying to guard against. I think it's important to note that leading up to Saturday, there was no intelligence that indicated that protest would turn violent and destructive. And so it is difficult to know, but I'm grateful that now it's coming out that, even Sunday night and Monday night, they were early on called very peaceful, but there was some serious threats there. I want to give a shout out to West Valley City Police Department, who worked with the FBI to intercept some people on their way to the protest on Monday night with an AK-47 with a silencer and an Uzi, who had posted threats and was intent, I think, on creating some tragedy. So it wasn't all safe and peaceful since Saturday, and at this point we feel secure about moving forward without a curfew.
And is that because you don't predict further violence, either against property or people? I mean, I guess, how are those predictions now being made? Is it just sort of evaluating the fact that the past few days protests have been as peaceful as they have been, or what is the calculus there?
Yeah, I think for the most part, we saw a dramatic shift in who was in control of the protest. And you saw people policing each other since Saturday night. And when someone would throw a water bottle or climb up on an awning, people would say, hey, get down, that's not what this is about, or stop this. There were windows broken out of the police vehicle, military vehicle at the protest the other night. And people were shutting that down with each other. The protest last night, again, pretty peaceful. I'm grateful we were able to pick up the suspect who was suspected to have lit the fire on the police car. He's now off the streets, and we feel as secure as we can that the city is safe.
Did you know when you made the decision to lift the curfew that the other four officers who were on hand in Minneapolis when George Floyd was killed, did you know that they were being charged, or was that not part of the decision-making process?
No, my decision to lift the curfew was based in the same realm that it was placed, which is assessing the national climate, but really looking at our local intelligence.
Some people saw the concept of meeting protests against excessive policing with additional excessive policing and militarizing the response to protest as counterintuitive or running against the purpose of the protest itself. Can you talk about that conflict there? I mean,
yeah, we get it from both sides. And if you think back to 11 o'clock on Saturday, there was a lot of comments about where are the police? There's not many police. They were in unmarked cars. They were obviously there with directing traffic and making sure that people could make that loop around the public safety building. But We've also received criticism that the police were not present enough, but it was a strategic and a calculated decision by our police department, again, in looking at what happens around the country, that if there's a protest by people against the police or about the police, and you send the police out immediately, you're going to incite conflict there. And we didn't want to make the police the target of the protest. We wanted to allow the protest the freedom to have their voices heard and be out there on the streets. So it was several hours really before the police presence in the gear came out, and not until the vehicle had been surrounded, flipped over, and lit on fire.
Yeah. Just finally, Mayor Mendenhall, as we look at the national conversation and what's been happening around the country and here locally, does policing in general need to change? I mean, speaking of evolution of policing.
Oh, my goodness. I mean, to see what happened in Minneapolis and to learn that it was in their policy and officers were trained to use a knee on people and put a knee on someone's neck. It's sickening. And Salt Lake City Police Department, thankfully, has expressly prohibits that kind of use of restraint. And certainly that doesn't mean that there's nothing to be learned and that we shouldn't be evolving as a police department and as a city. We should be, and we are. But I have every confidence that that is the culture of Salt Lake City Police Department. That's the reason they've been meeting for years on a monthly basis with community groups like Utahns Against Police Brutality and Black Lives Matter. And we're going to keep meeting with them. And we had a meeting yesterday with leaders of our Black community here locally, and where the police showed them hands-on. They brought a police officer in, put him on the ground, and showed him what the use of the restraint policy was, and what do you do if someone says they can't breathe, and what is the policy there? And that's the kind of work we have to keep doing. And I know we have a department who is open to that kind of constructive feedback.
Right, and it's sort of one specific aspect of complaints against police is that restraint use. And then there's, of course, just use of force in general and how quickly police around the country have turned to deadly weapons in certain instances. And I know it's an ongoing conversation, a difficult topic to address. And we'll have to address it again on a different show because we're out of time here. But Salt Lake City Mayor Aaron Mendenhall, thanks for making time.
Thanks for having me on.
Yeah. The Salt Lake City protests of this past weekend and those that have played out in the city every day since were sparked by the killing of George Floyd in Minneapolis. Now on the show, we're going to turn to a conversation about those protests and about the reform efforts long underway to try to change policing both here in Utah and around the nation. Lex Scott is the founder of Black Lives Matter Utah. I spoke to her Tuesday. Lex Scott, founder of Black Lives Matter Utah, thank you very much for making time for this.
Thank you for having me.
I want the focus of our conversation today to be about the police reforms you want to see implemented and have been advocating for some years. I do want to begin, though, by asking about something that you have already commented on in the press, which is this past weekend's protests. I've seen and heard you being, I don't know if upset is the right word, but not exactly pleased with how protests have gone down. You condemned the violent turn of the protests, but you also had some words about what we really ought to be mourning. Can you just maybe offer your assessment of how the protests went down this past weekend?
Yes, and I just want to make sure everyone knows that the protests that were held were not held by Black Lives Matter Utah.
Right.
And the people who held them are not affiliated with Black Lives Matter Utah. I was in Minneapolis protesting. So the first thing I think of when I see those protests is, you know, they break buildings, they burn things. And I think Black Lives Matter doesn't mourn broken buildings. We mourn broken bodies. You can replace a building. You can replace a car. You can never replace Patrick Harmon, who was killed by police, Elijah Smith, Bobby Duckworth, Dylan Taylor, James Barker, Andrea Europe, Bobby Valencia. And so that's the first thing I think. I think that Martin Luther King said the riot is the language of the unheard. John F. Kennedy said those who make peaceful revolution impossible make violent revolution inevitable. Mm-hmm. That's the first thing I think of. And then the next thing I think of is, you know, when you burn a building and you burn a car, you're taking away from the message of what we're trying to accomplish here. The headline is no longer about police brutality victims or police violence. The narrative is completely turned to criminalize Black people and say, look, Black people deserve to be killed by police. Look at them burning the city, even though it's white people who are starting the fires and destroying the property. So, yeah, I feel like there is a place for Black rage. Black rage is warranted. I feel like protest should be used as a tool. It should be used strategically. And it's not my place to lecture other people right. about how to protest or where to protest. But I think that my anger came from the fact that I was in Minneapolis. My chapter wasn't holding a protest, and I have received over 100 calls from media sources across this country saying Black Lives Matter started a violent protest, and it's not okay.
And you've clarified that here. I guess one last thing on this before we move on. Can protests become better? I mean, you know, the quote-unquote violence, the flames, the confrontation, that can draw a lot of media attention. I don't know, Lex, is there a different way of doing protests when so many people with so many different takes on making that statement are going to show up at a protest? Is there anything to be done about the fact that, you know, at some point, at, you know, on occasion, some people are going to express their rage in the way that you're describing? I mean, how do you fix that part of protest, and do you even fix it?
Well, I mean, I am not a perfect leader. I'm very flawed. You'll never find a perfect civil rights leader. You can search a million years and you'll never find one. One who was close was Martin Luther King, and he was able to organize thousands upon thousands of people to walk across the Edmund Pettus Bridge and block the bridge. And that was them remaining peaceful, and then the police incited violence. And so I do believe that it is very possible to organize thousands of people to not be violent, but it requires a lot of planning. And I feel like in this time, this historical time we're living in, you know, everyone wants a protest. I got hundreds of emails about, please hold a protest, please hold a protest. And people don't understand with Black Lives Matter, you know, our protests are scheduled 2 weeks out or a month out for a reason, so that we can get the message out, so that we can plan, so that we know that the people attending know that we're not going to destroy property or incite violence. And what is the unified message we're sending at that protest that day?
And I feel like that's something we could delve into a lot deeper. I don't want to focus entirely on protests and how they go wrong and right here. I want to turn to the topic of this conversation, which is that you and Black Lives Matter Utah have been meeting for a while now with the police here in Utah's capital city. And we've talked about this before on this very show. But what has been the subject of those conversations? Remind us of that, Lex. And then what have those meetings been like?
Yes. And so those meetings are with the community activist group. Those meetings are open to the public. Those meetings are not run by Black Lives Matter. We have Black Lives Matter members in there. We have police brutality victims yeah. in there. We have just regular citizens in there. And the entire meetings are about police reform, police accountability, and transparency. And due to those meetings, which please don't give, I mean, I don't want anyone to give Black Lives Matter all the credit for this. You know, there's a victim named James Barker. His wife attends those meetings. Gina Thane, the mother of Dylan Taylor, attends those meetings. And so many police brutality victims attend those meetings. And Heidi Kielbaugh brought Arbinger training, which is de-escalation training, to the police department in Salt Lake City. We have de-escalation training now. We have implicit bias training now. The police are removing lethal weapons from the police cars and replacing them with less than lethal weapons. We have body cam footage policies. Those body cam footage policies were protested for by UAPB, Black Lives Matter, and other organizations. So we've created a lot of change within that one police department. However, you know, that's why I wrote a police reform bill, because not all the changes that are needed have been completed. And we need not only one police department in this nation to be reformed. We need every police department in this nation to be reformed.
Lex, I have a couple questions. One is, you know, you talked about the implicit bias training and de-escalation and so on and so forth. Does this training, does it work? And I guess the reason I'm asking that question is because there are folks out there, people who want to see the police basically dismantled altogether, and they see the entire institution of the police as servants of the injustice that is inherent in the system that we all live in. And so, you know, does the training work? And then, you know, what's your view, Lex, on the necessity of the police in the world we live in, and whether and how this training actually does enact reform, or does it? Boy, that's a long and kind of complicated question there.
Well, the training, you know, the studies have shown the training is not stopping or lowering police violence, okay? I feel like the training can't hurt, and I feel like the training is needed, but I feel like the three most important parts that we need are the following. We need data collection. That's step one, data collection, because when Black people say, hey, we're being pulled over at five times the rate of white people and given higher sentences for lesser crimes, people say, no, that's in your head, you're pulling the race card, blah, blah, blah. But when I tell the police department, I want you to track the race, age, and gender of every person that you pull over and arrest, then we have that hard data that says, hey, statistically, they are profiling Black and brown people. We are only 2% of the population in Salt Lake City, but we are 70% of the people pulled over and arrested. That's unequal. The second part that we need is stronger use of force policies in this nation and excessive force policies. At this point, an officer can clearly say, I feared for my life, shoot an unarmed Black person, and get away with that. That's not okay. Fearing for your life should not be justification to kill someone, okay? So we need stronger use of force policies. And the last step that we need is civilian oversight, because at this point, when there's an officer-involved shooting in Salt Lake City, West Valley City comes in and investigates Salt Lake City police and finds them innocent. Then 2 months later, when West Valley Police has an officer-involved shooting, Salt Lake Police comes, investigates West Valley Police, and finds them innocent. And it's a conflict of interest. It's, you know, police are not should not be allowed to investigate themselves and find themselves innocent for police brutality. So I am pushing in my police reform bill to have every police department have a civilian oversight board that has the power to investigate and bring charges against police. We don't want police officers to be able to sit on these boards or their relatives. We want independent investigations because there's a conflict of interest, and the public is angry right now because police are not held accountable for police brutality cases.
It's interesting that idea of you wash my back, I wash yours, kind of we're going to exonerate each other back and forth. You know, why, and maybe you can't address this, Lex, but why are there not stronger civilian review boards for each of the police departments in Utah right now?
Well, so civilian review boards aren't a new idea. It's not an original idea. It's not my idea. There are civilian oversight boards in cities across this country. I made a spreadsheet once. There are hundreds of civilian oversight boards, and each one is different. Last year, I believe it was, there was a representative named Paul Ray who passed a bill, HB 415, saying it is illegal to form civilian oversight boards in Utah. Now, his bill has so many holes in it, it's like a cheese grater. I know ways I can get around this bill. I don't want to mention them because then he'll just write another bill fixing his holes. So I might work on a ballot initiative fixing the holes in his thing. But, you know, it's really hard to get civilian oversight. The police in Utah have something called the CRB, and they call it a civilian oversight board. Police are allowed to sit on this board. The person who runs the board is former law enforcement. The people on the board are appointed by the mayor. We did an experiment once where we sent activists to apply for the open seats on the board none of them were chosen, and there are still empty seats to this day on that board. They don't have power to bring charges against police. They investigate officer misconduct, and when they're finished with their investigation, they make a recommendation to the chief of police whether to fire the police officer, whether to charge the police officer. Then the chief of police looks at that recommendation, and he can make the decision himself as to what to do in the situation. To me, it's all for show. If you have no power, then why are you here? So, yeah, I've been working, you know, there's other organizations, not just Black Lives Matter, like UAPB pushed for civilian review boards for 6 years as well. And I'm not speaking for UAPB. I'm not, you know, a leader there. I'm not a member there. I'm just telling you that they have also been pushing for civilian review boards.
And this is UAPB is Utahns Against Police Brutality. You know, we've had this conversation before, Lex, and we're going to have it again as much as I'd like to say otherwise. And it's entirely probable that another event like the killing of George Floyd is going to happen, and we'll come back and keep trying to contribute to this conversation. But I guess, you know, given everything you just said about what you're trying to do, the police reform bill you're trying to run, but also the fact that we keep having this conversation, do you see any incremental progress from your perspective or any reason for hope, Lex?
Well, hope. Hope is a beautiful thing. I heard a quote once. I don't know who said it. And the person who said it said, never deprive someone of hope. It may be the only thing they have left. And I feel like that is very representative of this situation. If I didn't have hope, I wouldn't be able to wake up in the morning, because civil rights, you know, in the movies, they paint it as this, like, romantic thing, like this thing where all these people solve problems and it's magical. But really working in civil rights, it's traumatic and depressing. And the only thing that keeps us going is that we have hope. But I'm not resting on hope. I have a fire lit under me right now for the police reform bill. And at this point, I hope that a legislator somewhere in this nation is brave enough to carry this bill. That's my hope, because I know there's one out there. It's just a matter of finding them. No one knows who I am. People know who I am in Salt Lake City, but nobody knows who I am nationwide. Right. I was on CNN last week, but no one knows who I am. And so it's really hard when I call senators like Maxine and say, hey, I'm Lex Scott. Will somebody have Maxine call me? Sure, we will, as they giggle and hang up on me. So, yeah, my hope is that I can get a legislator who has the fortitude, the courage to carry this bill.
You know, just talking about the sort of broader overarching systemic issues that we have here in the United States of America. Lex, you and I have known each other for a long time. We went to elementary school together. And back then, you know, you didn't know that I'd be this radio reporter. I didn't know that you'd be the activist you'd become. And here's where I'm going with this. You and I, as 80s kids, the effort that educators and, you know, public television and even some nuns with guitars tried to instill in all of us was the idea that despite our different skin colors, we're all the same on the inside. You are now involved in education efforts with Black Lives Matter Utah, and I'm wondering if that message of sameness, from your perspective, is the right message today to try to combat racism from an early age. And I think the reason that I ask that is because the sameness might ignore some uncomfortable history that's out there. I don't know. I'll let you answer the question, Lex. The idea that cutting off racism early by sort of downplaying the differences. Do you want to talk about that?
Yeah, I will. So I am TikTok famous. Just kidding. There's an app called TikTok that I went viral on. And a few weeks ago, like I think I'm at 92,000 followers now. I've been on there for a month. And a few weeks ago, I posted a video about the Brown Eye, Blue Eye experiment by Jane Elliott. It is on YouTube. Yeah. And then I also posted the doll study, the Anderson Cooper doll study, which is also on YouTube. And these two experiments are basically the doll study is they took hundreds of white children, hundreds of black children. They put them in a room with pictures of white dolls and black dolls, and they asked them questions like, which doll is stupid? Which doll is mean? Which doll is ugly? And when they asked these questions, you know, the majority of the kids, black and white, pointed to the black dolls. And then when they said, which doll is smart? Which doll is beautiful? Which doll does everyone like? They pointed to the white doll. The doll study started in the 60s, but Anderson Cooper remade it. And it shows us that implicit bias and racism is developed by the age of five in children. And then the blue eye, brown eye experiment shows Jane Elliott. She went into her classroom the day after Martin Luther King was assassinated, and she said, I just want to let you know, blue-eyed kids are better than every other kid. Brown-eyed kids are not smart. They're troublemakers. Blue-eyed kids get more time at recess, more food, more snacks. And she separated the kids in her classroom just to kind of see how they would treat each other, react to each other, and how it felt to be discriminated against. And then she switched the experiment and said, oh, I was mistaken. It's actually brown-eyed kids who are the best kids, and they get extra privileges, and they get extra food. And, you know, kids that were in that experiment said that it changed their entire lives, and they actually learned what it felt like to be discriminated against. So, you know, people like to say, I don't see color. And they know every time I'm going to say, you better see my color. My color is beautiful. People go tanning to have this color. Do not erase my color. Do not try to make yourself more comfortable, because talking about racism makes white people uncomfortable. Every time we bring it up, they try to silence us by saying, stop pulling the race card, instead of dealing with racism. And they say, stop talking about it and it will go away. If you had cancer and you went to the doctor wouldn't say, stop talking about it and it will go away. We have to have uncomfortable conversations about racism to further ourselves.
Well, on that point, and we'll wrap up here, Lex, you know, as you think about the latest tragic circumstance, you know, the latest killing, the killing of George Floyd in Minneapolis, and there's probably been, you know, a more recent killing, actually, now that I think about it, and as I say the word latest, but what would you ask those who are listening to this program right now to do, to take action, to try and combat the racism that you just finished describing?
Ask people to do, I would ask them to go to my website, blacklivesmatterutah.com, sign our petition for police reform. I would ask them to speak out against racism every time they see it in every situation. You can't just be an activist at home. You have to be an activist at school, at work, and in church as well. I would ask people to figure out what their center of influence is and then affect that center. If you are a teacher, you're affecting children. Bring racial conversations into classrooms. If you are a police officer, speak out against police brutality. Ask for reforms to the police department. You can kneel, we can hold hands, we can have kumbaya moments with police, but we need actual reform. So I would ask people out there to work every day to bring attention to racial issues and educate themselves about systemic racism and systematic oppression of black and brown people in this nation. And basically just go from there. Let's just keep fighting and pushing for a police reform bill until we get it.
Lex Scott, founder of Black Lives Matter Utah and a childhood friend of mine, talking about efforts long underway to try to change policing in Utah and around the nation, and about confronting racism on a daily basis. So, what are you doing to try to improve things? Do you acknowledge the problem of racism, of unequal opportunity and inherent bias? How do you define systemic racism? And then, ultimately, how do you dismantle it? Not that those are questions that you can answer in a pithy comment on social media, but if you'd like to share your thoughts, we're all ears. Email us at comments@kcpw.org, or add your own observations to the Facebook show post for today's episode. And obviously, as Lex Scott said at the end of our interview, This can't be a one-off conversation and requires our ongoing attention. It's also a topic that we definitely will return to as a result here on In the Hive. And that does it for In the Hive here on KCPW Salt Lake Public Radio. I'm Roger McDonough. Thanks for listening. Join us again next week.